Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And joining me for the roundtable this week, Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey, happy Monday.
And Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back, Megan.
Happy to be here.
And Aaron Glenn, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Aaron.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. So despite the pleas from Democrats and students and faculty from around the state, Governor DeWine has signed the controversial higher education bill, also known as Senate Bill 1. This was expected. He said he was likely to do it, and now he has, but he didn't waste any time. Aaron, were you surprised at how quickly he signed it?
Yes. So we've seen the governor with other controversial bills take a little bit more time, leave them on his desk for a little bit more time before signing, but it was a quick Friday afternoon news dump.
Yeah. Anybody else? Were you thinking he'd take a little time to think about it or weigh options?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes even just procedurally, his office will tell us, oh, well, the governor hasn't actually received the bill yet, even though the Senate or the House or whomever has voted to pass it on to the governor. Mm-hmm. But in this case, clearly he got the bill very quickly, because seriously, in previous legislative sessions, when he's got a lot of bills coming to him, like right at the end of lame duck, it can take like a week for him to physically get the bill. But, you know, he said he was probably going to sign it. He even hinted at some of the things in Senate Bill 1 in his State of the State address. So I think the timing was maybe a little surprising. And of course, he signed it Friday morning, but he did not invite press to that event. He just invited the sponsors and legislative leaders and such. So definitely pretty quick turnaround. I would say even less than 2 days in some regards.
Definitely the fastest I've seen. Not that I've been covering state politics for too terribly long, but this is one of the fastest bills I've seen him sign so quickly.
Now, did he give any remarks when he signed it, or he just kind of sent out a picture and was there a press release?
There was a press release that said he signed the bill. I mean, no one, to my knowledge, has caught up with the governor yet. Of course, he signed it on Friday, and then his team released that pretty late in the work day. He's up in Toledo today, I believe. So, you know, we'll see.
Someone will track him down.
Yeah, we'll see what he has to say this week. Yeah. I'm sure he'll have more to weigh in on the bill and its effects and why he ultimately decided to sign it.
Well, and before he signed it, I know in a couple interviews he said that he wanted to make sure the college campuses had an environment that fostered an open dialogue, that people were hearing from students from all sides of the political spectrum. So I imagine that was on his mind as he signed it.
At the Columbus Metropolitan Club last week, before he signed the bill, but he was asked questions about it, the governor said he wanted to go through the bill again and review the legislation. And then he added this.
It wouldn't be the first time that something gets passed and everybody looks at it 6 months later or a year later and says, hey, that wasn't what we intended, or there's been, you know, didn't turn out the way we wanted to. So I think with any bill, you're always open. And I think as a state, we should always be open to re-examining everything.
So, Megan, that makes me think that maybe he didn't agree with every single thing in the bill, or maybe he was thinking that a few of the details in it were maybe not quite what he wanted.
Yeah, it's possible. It's a massive bill. There's quite a few things that are in there, from banning DEI to prohibiting faculty strikes to how conversations in the classrooms and discussions in the classrooms can be had around certain topics, all the way to board of trustee like tenure. So it's very possible there are some things that he maybe might not agree with. But Senator Serena was very clear that he did not want to make changes to this bill like he did to his similar bill in the last General Assembly that went through nearly a dozen revisions. So, yeah, we'll see. Like Aaron was saying, time will tell. How this will change college campuses.
And Sarah, Megan just listed off a few of the things in the bill. I mean, that's probably not even half of them because it's a very big bill. Is there any particular provision that stuck out to you that because this bill had like one of the most testimony against it happen in recent memory?
Yeah, I mean, I think a piece that was particularly unpopular and extended beyond maybe students and faculty is this ban on faculty strikes, because you're seeing unions who maybe don't represent professors, but they represent police or other, you know, jobs that you are represented by a union. Oftentimes unions see a strike against some unionized workers as a strike against all unionized workers. So I think that, you know, banning faculty from striking, although Senator Serino and sponsors say that's, you know, looking out for students because they don't want students who are paying to go to the state's universities losing out on time in the classroom. Unions see that as a strike on collective bargaining. So I think, of course, that was a piece last time around that was a concession that Senator Serino made. But we'll have to see because, you know, I think it's almost inevitable. Oh, my gosh. It's almost inevitable that there's a lawsuit over this bill. I mean, with any controversial piece of legislation, when you've got a lot of opponents and some proponents or a lot of proponents and a lot of opponents, wherever it lies, there ends up being a lawsuit. So I'm sure this will go through the courts.
Yeah, there are some legal considerations here. Who have you heard might sue to kind of stop parts of the bill?
Well, it kind of depends on what piece of the bill. You know, I don't know that unions will sue, but I could see unions filing some sort of a lawsuit over the faculty strike piece. I was at a press conference on Wednesday of last week, the day that the Senate concurred on the bill and sent it to Governor DeWine, so 2 days before he signed it. And the Legislative Black Caucus had a press conference, and the NAACP was there. And the NAACP at the federal level is, of course, filing some lawsuits against the Trump administration. So I asked if the NAACP of Ohio would be leading the effort, and they said they're waiting on national directive. But you could also see, I mean, of course, a lot of black lawmakers, Democratic black lawmakers, have called this bill out as what they see as racist. So there are a lot of different interest groups here that could ultimately be filing a lawsuit because it does, you know, you've seen it's a big bill with a lot of provisions, and it's not like folks are going to sue over the entire bill. It's likely going to be provisions within the bill.
And as Sarah just said, among those who urged Governor DeWine to veto were members of the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus who condemned the ending of DEI initiatives that's included in the bill. Here's Cincinnati Senator Katherine Ingram speaking at a news conference. This is a couple of days before DeWine signed it into law.
How dare you act like I'm a DEI hire? I had to do more than to get to even being considered, let alone hired.
Now, there's a lot being said about the DEI stuff. It's not just in this Senate Bill 1, but it's also happening from the Trump administration. You know, Megan, what are your thoughts on the future of DEI at universities here?
Yeah, it certainly does not look good. even before Senate Bill 1 was signed into law by Governor DeWine, because of Trump's his letter to colleges and universities and schools, Ohio State University, ended their DEI programming. We've seen some events at Ohio colleges and universities that have been canceled, such as Ohio University's Black Alumni Reunion Weekend that was scheduled for April. That was canceled as a result of this Dear Colleagues letter that was sent out in February. So we're already seeing some changes on campuses before this bill was signed into law. So I think now with this bill going into effect, we'll see colleges and universities, public colleges and universities, that is, reviewing their policies and procedures in time for the next fall semester when this bill will have taken effect.
Ohio State President Ted Carter was on this program last week, and he said that he defended his position and his decision to close 2 DEI offices and eliminate 16 positions. He said that diversity, equity, and inclusion will live on at Ohio State. He didn't give exact details, but he said that there's other initiatives where a lot of the things that they did will continue, I guess with different words, different names. He didn't really go into much detail about that. But he also said that he and other university presidents worked behind the scenes to have input and impact on this legislation, but they never really spoke publicly about it. Aaron, were you seeing that as an issue for a lot of the students and faculty who were on the ground protesting?
Yeah, well, I think that there was a lot of discussions in hearings of the bill about which marginalized communities would be a part of this DEI legislation. Would sororities be affected, Veterans Affairs, first-time college students? I think that there were a lot of questions about who exactly is women's centers at universities, like which exact programs would be affected? And I think that that's going to be something we continue to see as the legislation takes effect.
If you have a sorority that's for, you know, like that has all of its members are mainly from one particular community, is that allowed? Is that what you mean?
Right.
Right. Yes. I don't think anyone knows the answer to that.
That's kind of part of this bill. Yeah, there's so many like questions. Some of the, a lot of the language is very vague, which a lot of the opponents of this bill think is intentional. So, yeah, it's kind of, I think, left to interpretation is how these universities are going to take this bill into consideration.
And the enforcement mechanisms in the bill, a lot of it is just self-reporting. So students who feel like they had an interaction that goes against this bill can report it. Is that your understanding?
That's how I understand it. Yes, mm-hmm. That is correct.
All right. Well, we'll have to see. The bill is signed, which means it becomes law in 90 days. Is that? Yep. This is All Sides, and this is the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. With us is Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Aaron Glenn, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Another piece of legislation on the governor's desk is an $11 billion transportation budget bill. It passed with overwhelming support, but Democrats are raising concerns over a provision that covers voter registration. Sarah, why is voter registration in the transportation budget?
Yeah, so this was kind of a piece that folks went back and forth and back and forth over in the both the House and the Senate. The transportation budget primarily deals with transportation funding for the Ohio Department of Transportation, but it also deals with some policy at like BMVs, for example. And you can register to vote at a BMV. So Republican lawmakers in the House first added this provision that would require proof of citizenship if you're registering to vote at a BMV. That was taken out and made so that only if a BMV registrar saw that someone was not eligible to register to vote, they couldn't ask them if they wanted to register to vote. So Democrats saw that as kind of a concession. They were cool with that. The transportation budget passed unanimously out of the House. And then the Senate added the proof of citizenship thing back in. And of course, this has been an ongoing conversation, not just at BMVs. Secretary of State Frank LaRose has been encouraging lawmakers to look at adding proof of citizenship requirements in other regards, but it kind of bled into this conversation at BMVs, and ultimately the transportation budget that was passed on to Governor Mike DeWine included this proof of citizenship requirement.
And it, but isn't it just a matter of when you fill out your voter registration form, it says, are you a citizen, and you check yes?
Well, that's the current law, but now I believe you'd have to provide documentation. That's my understanding, that you are a citizen.
Okay. Does it say what that would be?
I'd have to go back in the bill because, like I said, I was following it and it was in and then out and then in and now it's back
so,
in.
So Governor DeWine at that same Columbus Metropolitan Club event said he's reluctant about signing another election-related law. Megan, can he line item veto this one thing out of the transportation budget?
I believe so.
Bill that has appropriations, the governor is able to line item veto, so the transportation budget would be one of them. But for example, going back to Senate Bill 1,
he couldn't do that.
Yes, because there was no money involved.
I see. Okay. So do you think if he said at the Columbus Metropolitan Club that he doesn't want to deal with another election-related law, he might take it out?
It's very possible. Yes, we've definitely seen him line in veto things out of budget bills before. So it's very possible. So I think he's keeping the cards close to the vest. Right
at the
now.
Same time, though, he's been saying for a while that he doesn't want to sign any more election changes, and then he signs them. So like this goes back like more than one General Assembly. He signed that voter ID law into law and said he wasn't going to sign any more election changes after that. But then, of course, there was the whole foreign money to ballot issue bill that passed last year as part of special session, and he signed that. So I don't know. It remains to be seen. And of course, the Trump administration is putting a lot of pressure on states to, make their election laws stronger in his mind.
Now, Aaron, this bill passed overwhelmingly. The transportation budget did. Democrats, Republicans, everyone voted for it, despite this voter registration provision in it. So it's on his desk. Do we know when he's expected to sign it?
I believe he needs to sign it by today, according to the regular transportation budget process. And there I think it's possible that he'll do a line of veto. There's definitely things in this transportation budget that he explicitly asked the legislature for, including he wanted a traditional driver's license requirements, which he's been calling for from Springfield. So I think that he'll probably sign the bill.
All right. Well, I guess we'll see. And if it's today, then, you know, we'll talk about it next week. So we will continue the reporter roundtable in just a moment. We're going to talk about the Browns stadium and the owners of the Browns wanting some money from the state. And we're also going to talk about many more things. The reporter roundtable continues on all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Aaron Glenn, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Now, I wanted to discuss the Cleveland Browns. So, a state funding for a domed stadium in Brook Park for the Cleveland Browns continues to be a point of contention. Governor DeWine and his Republican colleagues in the General Assembly do not seem to be on the same page about this. The governor addressed this during his talk at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. The forum enabled him to talk about his proposed budget, and Governor DeWine wants to double the tax on sports betting and use that money. But Republican lawmakers want to give $600 million to the Browns by issuing bonds to build the new stadium. So, Megan, what is the back and forth on this idea?
Yeah, so the Cleveland Browns, you know, they want this new, the owners of the Cleveland Browns want this new stadium. And so they're asking the state for some money. And basically, there's just discrepancy on how to actually fund this. So Governor DeWine is proposing doubling the tax on sports betting. And he's arguing that, you know, this won't necessarily, the people who are partaking in betting aren't going to see, you know, an increase in that. That's going to be the companies that are paying this, and that money, the revenue generated, can go towards youth athletics and can go for sports stadiums. Because it's not just the Browns that are going to need a new stadium. It's going to be, you know, the Bengals, it's going to be the Columbus Crew. There's a plethora of professional sports teams across the state. And so Governor DeWine is saying that his solution will be a one-size-fits-all, essentially, one-and-done, so that future governors, future general assemblies won't have to deal with this issue. However, the Republicans in the House disagree with what Governor DeWine is putting forth and want to do this through bonds instead. Now, Governor DeWine did kind of dance around the question of, you know, if he would line item veto it, saying that the budget still has quite a long way to go in the House, and then also going over to the Senate before it would even end up back on his desk. So
This idea of the $600 million bonds, Sarah, do we know where this came from?
Well, I know that the Browns, the Haslam Sports Group, of course, the owners of the Browns, came to the State House and gave a presentation about their proposed project in Brook Park. And, you know, they have a lot of cost estimates about how much it would cost to do this. Of course, how much money they'd potentially get from the state or how much money they'd need from the state to do this. And then, of course, you know, there's a whole debate up in Cleveland happening that we are not necessarily at the center of, because the city and county are involved in this, too. And the city and county, of course, are frustrated with this proposal to move the stadium from downtown Cleveland to a suburb, Brook Park, which is where this domed stadium would be built. So I want to say this bonds proposal, the number came from sometime around that presentation that they gave, because the draft legislation came out shortly after my colleague Karen Kassler was able to get that draft legislation. And we're going to see the House's version of the budget sometime this week, so we'll see if that $600 figure is put in there. But like Megan said, it's really early. I mean, I think early on, lawmakers were quick to kind of say they didn't want to go with what Governor DeWine was proposing. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, Aaron, there's a lot of talk. Governor DeWine had a lot of increases in the so-called sin taxes. There's the cigarette tax, marijuana, sports betting. And the Republicans are coming out slowly, trickling out, saying, we don't want all these tax increases.
Right. I think with the tobacco tax specifically, Republicans have said, well, that's probably going to be a dwindling source of revenue in the future. Do we really want to tie things like the child tax credit to that money if it's we're not confident it's always going to be there?
I mean, allegedly, you know, fewer people smoking. Is that what you
mean?
Yes. I see. Well, I think that there was some tax on vaping, too, you know.
Right. So,
okay. And then does anyone know if Democrats have weighed in at all on the Browns getting money for a new stadium?
Well, you see a range of responses, but there are some Democrats who are opposed outright because they are asking, you know, why are we subsidizing billionaires? I mean, the Haslams are billionaires. And some of these Democrats believe they should spend the money to build the project because, of course, on the flip side, once it's built, if they build this stadium in Brook Park, they're going to be charging more for parking, more for tickets, you know, all of these other price increases that are included in this presentation that the Browns brought forward. So, I mean, I've definitely heard some Democrats questioning why the state is pitching in at all. And you hear the most opposition from Cleveland area Democrats, who, again, it's twofold. A, they don't think the state should be giving the Haslams money, but B, why are they moving out of Cleveland itself?
They want
to
keep
with
the current stadium.
Sure.
Yeah. I can understand doming it. You know, it is cold, but
I don't want to go too far into the Pittsburgh Steelers yes. references, yes. but I cannot imagine the Pittsburgh Steelers personally playing in any
suburb
of yes. Pennsylvania, but that's the Steelers.
Yes. Well, full disclosure, Sarah and I are Steelers fans, so, you know, we're going to sit here and ask if the Browns, you know, need a new stadium.
Do they need to have a Mike Tomlin winning record to
right.
get that new stadium?
Maybe they do, but I guess, you know, we'll see what happens. Also, football is a shorter season than a lot of other sports. There's only 7 or 8 home games.
I think I've heard, too, and I don't know if this is what you guys have heard, that some of the pitch is it wouldn't just be, you know, if they get this upgraded stadium, maybe the Browns could be in contention to host the Super Bowl at the domed stadium, or concerts, other things. I mean, it's this idea of when you have a nice, shiny new stadium, it's not just those home games for the Browns.
I feel like saying if you build it, they will come. Is that the...
Maybe
all right,
so.
Maybe so. All right. We'll have to see what happens whenever the House releases their budget. Another thing I wanted to discuss is lawmakers in the House are passed energy generation legislation. It included an immediate rollback of controversial subsidies for 2 aging power plants. So, Sarah, I believe that you have been writing about this. Remind us why these 2 aging power plants are important and why this is significant that they rolled this back.
Sure. So that's the last remaining legislative piece of House Bill 6 from 2019, which was the legislative portion of a nuclear power plant bailout scandal. It, of course, for those who followed it, landed former Republican House Speaker Larry Householder in jail, former Ohio Republican Party Chair Matt Borges in jail. They're both in federal prison for their involvement in this pay-to-play bribery scheme. It's also been connected to 2 suicides, this case. So it's a case with a lot of long-reaching tentacles, mm-hmm. but included in that legislation were bailouts to 2 aging coal plants, one of which is in Indiana. Democratic lawmakers have been bringing forward repeals of those subsidies for years, but, you know, they finally caught traction and got bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. And what I've heard from lawmakers is that it's just enough time has passed that enough folks don't have to defend why they did or did not vote for House Bill 6 in 2019 as reason for why they can get rid of these subsidies and get rid of the subsidies immediately. But that immediate portion was cause for a lot of debate over in the House.
So this did pass the House, or it still have to be taken up in the Senate?
So the Senate and the House passed their own versions of the bill. Each bill includes that immediate rollback of the subsidies. What comes next is the chairs of the House and Senate Energy Committees kind of need to get together, come to terms with some differences, because the bills aren't identical, although they include a lot of the same provisions. And then we'll see which bill moves. If the House moves the Senate bill, if the Senate moves the House bill. But I mean, you've got a situation where each chamber has passed their own version of the bill that include a lot of the same provisions. So clearly these ideas have legs.
Okay. So we'll have to just keep an eye on when the energy bill, what do they call it, concurring, they have to like,
yeah, they have to, they have to, well, they have to find common ground between the two chambers, so that, you know, a bill obviously has to pass both chambers and they all have to agree on all of those changes. And of course this goes beyond just repealing those OVEC subsidies. There are, I mean, they're really lengthy bills, and energy policy gets into a lot of jargon that I try to avoid, but lawmakers say that this will usher in a new era of energy generation, a non-discriminate era of energy generation, where, you know, they want folks to be building plants here to generate energy here, so that Ohio, right now, Ohio is using more energy than it's supplying.
Hmm. All right. And just overall, Aaron, it seems like lawmakers are intent on passing a lot more bills this legislative session than they did in the last General Assembly. Last time, it was the lowest number of bills in decades. Do you feel, just from your perspective on reporting all of this, is more being fast-tracked? Is there more going on this time around?
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely a lot less gridlock than we saw last session when, you know, then-Speaker Jason Stevens had kind of made a deal with the Democrats. And so we saw the House and the Senate had very different ideas about what kind of legislation they wanted to pass. This time, Senate President Rob McCauley and Speaker Matt Huffman seem like they're much more in sync with each other. So things are definitely moving a lot more quickly.
What about with the budget? Do you feel like it's moving faster, too?
But it's kind of, I feel like, its own beast, with the House dealing with it first, and then we'll get changes with it this week, and then going over to the Senate. So it kind of remains to be seen, like, how eye-to-eye the House and the Senate will see on the budget. But it's very possible, since McCauley and Huffman do seem to be more eye-to-eye. But there are differences, as the energy bill, there's one in each chamber. Similar to with marijuana, there's one in each chamber dealing with how to kind of change the current law. So I think there are some nuances that, you know, we'll see differences in.
Yeah, I'm especially interested to see, because I think marijuana law got very held up in the House last year, and I think that there was a lot of blame placed on Speaker Jason Stevens, but I think it's coming to light that it wasn't just former Speaker Jason Stevens like holding off on trying to get this marijuana vote. I think that House lawmakers, have a lot more of them are in districts that are pro marijuana, and they're walking a tight line on if they want to actually pass serious changes to recreational marijuana law.
Yeah, so on the marijuana provisions, so there's two different bills going on. The Senate has a version, the House has a version, but either way, it's trying to walk back some of the things that voters voted whenever they passed the initiated statute, right?
Yes. The Senate makes significantly more changes to marijuana law. I would say that the House version is probably a little bit friendlier to, especially to the industry, but also to consumers. Like, for example, I know one of the big provisions that got a lot of outcry was the Senate version, like, cut back on home grow, but I don't think the House version cuts back on home grow. And, you know, the Senate has continuously sent marijuana bills over to the House, and the House has done nothing with them. So we'll see. This is the first House-introduced marijuana bill, and I don't even know that the House is so busy with the budget that I don't even know that they've done much with their version.
I believe you spoke with a woman who called marijuana natural medicine. So there's also that component of this bill. They want to change recreational marijuana, but it also will end up changing medical marijuana.
It will. It links the programs a little bit more. But that's something that you see in legal states when folks, you know, whether it's constituents or legislatures vote to legalize recreational marijuana, you see medical marijuana programs kind of disappear into the wind. Like, obviously the state is still maintaining its medical marijuana program, and like, if you have a card, you can access certain products that are not available for recreational use. You get priority at some dispensaries. You have a separate line at some dispensaries. But, you know, less folks, even folks who are part of the medical program, may choose not to renew their card and just buy recreationally. So, I mean, it is pretty normal that, you know, that woman I talked to, I think she probably was a medical patient under the medical system, but she's buying it recreationally too.
And Megan or Aaron, have you been following any of the hearings on the marijuana legislation?
Yes, I have. And yeah, similar to what Sarah was saying, yeah, the House hasn't, because they've been so busy with the budget, they haven't really got a chance to have hearings on their version. But the Senate has passed their version of marijuana and has been sent over to the House. But similarly, there have been, to my knowledge at least, no hearings on the Senate's version of the bill over in the House yet.
Yeah. And you had it, Megan, you had an interesting quote in one of your stories where you said that people are walking into stores not looking to get high. They're looking for relief. So it just brings into all of these things about marijuana versus hemp products and other intoxicating products. It's all getting mixed up together.
Yes. Yes. Hemp is the other big thing that we're seeing as well here in the State House.
Well, and that's some of the difference between the Senate and the House. The Senate wants to legislate marijuana differently than hemp. Mm-hmm. The House thinks it should be done all in one bill. And a lot of what's on the table right now is a de facto ban on hemp products because it would put them behind dispensaries. But it's unlikely dispensaries are going to sell these products. I mean, they may sell some, but if you look at a dispensary right now, they're probably not selling like straight CBD products. They're selling
sell marijuana than CBD oils or hemp. Or just a whole bunch of products that they don't need.
But this is the one thing that, like, there is still very, in my opinion at least, intense gridlock over, like, you know, that the a lot of other things have moved in this legislature that didn't move last legislature. There has been no movement, like, true, like, this has legs and it's going to the governor movement since issue 2 passed. I'm sure something will make it to the governor eventually, but you know, lawmakers just don't seem content on finding serious common ground right now.
All right. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. And coming up, we're going to talk about what former U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown is up to. And we're also going to talk a little bit more about education policy. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Still with us in the studio is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Aaron Glenn, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Another part of the budget from Governor DeWine is to make state funding for colleges at least partially dependent on job placement rates. Essentially, the better your job placement rate at a university post-graduation, the more state funding you'll receive. There are fears that this will cause universities to prioritize certain careers over others, and there's a concern that it will eliminate some careers in the humanities and arts. So what are we seeing about this part of the budget and this idea of job placement?
I think it really, you know, I think it aligns with one of Governor DeWine's biggest priorities, which he really focused on in his State of the State address, and that's Ohio's workforce. And you saw Lieutenant Governor John Husted, former Lieutenant Governor, now Senator John Husted, focusing a lot on workforce as well. When you've got massive projects like Intel, like Anduril, like Joby, like all these projects that Jobs Ohio claims is, you know, bringing to the state, you want to have the workforce to be able to support that. And so I think that that is where the idea comes from and where the initiative comes from. But like you said, what does this look like?
It would be hard to track, right?
Yeah, because it's not. And I think more details obviously come, you know, when the governor rolls out the budget. He's got, here's my ideas and here's what I want the legislature to kind of chew on. And we're waiting on the House version of the budget. So we'll see if they keep this. But Governor DeWine says he thinks this makes Ohio, it would make Ohio the first state to tie significant amounts of funding to whether their graduates are getting jobs. But he says that's gainful employment, quote unquote. So is it gainful employment if you graduate with a degree in musical theater and then you have to wait tables for a year before you land your first acting role? You know, I think that there are questions about what that job right out of college looks like. Because, I mean, I personally know several of my friends who graduated with me, my closest group, I'm one of four of us working in the field that I got a degree in. Everyone else has gainful employment. It's just not in the field that they studied. They chose to pivot after college. So it's interesting to see what would count as quote unquote gainful employment under this.
Yeah, like what if you end up with if you have a philosophy degree, but you end up working at Intel, you know, you could. It doesn't like if you do the training and you get the job, right? So Megan or Aaron, what do you think of the idea of this job getting more money for job placement rates? Do you think that it will stay in the budget or you think it's maybe too complicated for a budget line item?
I think the Republicans sound like they are in favor of a measure like this. I do think it'll be interesting to see how this affects degrees beyond bachelor degrees, like if it'll discourage people from getting master's degrees, if that mm-hmm. counts as gainful employment, if you're doing something, if you're not in the workforce, but you are still pursuing education. But yeah, I think this is in line with what Republicans want to see in terms of workforce development.
I could see it also, you know, if more people are studying like data analytics or things like, I don't know what Intel needs to, or Anduril, the new, you know, defense place being built. Like if you're, it'll be more people studying in those fields because there'll be more recruiting in those fields, right? Because there'll be more guaranteed jobs. I could just see that happening.
Yeah, I think a lot of the details, like Sarah was kind of mentioning, need to be ironed out exactly like how this would work. And two, I feel like it's interesting that higher education has been such a focus lately of lawmakers and Governor DeWine as well. So I think just with Senate Bill 1, as we were previously discussing, I'm curious you know, how this maybe could like tie into that, like the effects of Senate Bill 1. And if we do see this, you know, students leaving Ohio, how this could kind of play into this aspect of the budget.
Another education-related item, not higher education, though. Megan, you wrote about a Republican bill that would automatically close low-performing public schools. Senator Andrew Brenner introduced the bill. Did he indicate how he would define poor-performing schools?
Yes, he did. So it's very like specific like parameters that I'm going to pull up here to make sure I have it all correct. But basically, the bill defines a poor-performing school as a school, whether a district-operated, community, or STEM, that serves grades 4 and up, that has performed in the bottom 5% among public schools based on its performance index score, for 3 consecutive years, and also is in the bottom 10% in its value added progress for 3 consecutive years. So basically, it has to be low performing in these certain categories for the consecutive years. So if all of a sudden it is out of the bottom for one of those years, then it would no longer be categorized as a poor performing school. But there are, you know, there's always going to be schools in the bottom. It's just a question of whether or not they're going to be consistently in the bottom.
Is there anything in the bill that if you're in the bottom for 2 years that the state will help you, you know, so that, or is it just, I
do not believe so. Okay. No, but this bill is early on. So, you know, there could be amendments or changes made. There was a meeting the other week where they had a proponent testimony scheduled, but there were no proponents. no proponent testimony submitted. So I'm not sure what will happen to this bill.
Yeah. So this could just be a new bill, a new idea, but it might not have legs right now.
Yeah. Interestingly, it was introduced late in the last General Assembly, but it just kind of ran out of time. Or it was introduced and then it saw movement towards the end, but then it just kind of ran out of time, but also received very little proponent testimony. So the senator is trying to bring it back and he has much more time to kind of, you know, change it if needed.
Well, another thing pivoting away from education, we brought this up briefly last week on the roundtable, and it's former Senator Sherrod Brown. He has moved from Cleveland to Columbus to be closer to grandchildren and closer to his wife's job at Denison University. But he also announced that he is forming a Dignity of Work Institute, which is going to be a nonpartisan think tank to highlight the struggles of workers. Does anyone have any thoughts on what you think the intentions behind his institute or this new idea is?
Well, if he wants to run in 2026, he has to keep his name in the headlines, of course, and he's been in public office long enough to know that. And I think it's in line with, you know, an issue he has talked about his entire career as a public servant is work and workers and unions and working Americans. And it's a little bit like reading tea leaves right now as to what Sherrod Brown might be running for in 2026, if he is in fact running. But of course, all of the press releases and promotional material for this Dignity of Work Institute refer to Americans. They don't refer to Ohioans. So it's clear that Brown is still looking on a federal level, at least with this Dignity of Work Institute.
Yeah, and he told the New York Times that he's weighing options for running for either Senate or governor, but didn't say yes or no in either way. So, Megan, when would he need to announce in order to have traction in the governor's race or the Senate?
I would say sooner rather than later, just to get funding and his name out there. I mean, the primaries will be early next year, so I'd say the sooner rather than later.
Well, and then speaking of the governor's race, on the Democratic side, Democratic hopeful Dr. Amy Acton released campaign fundraising figures, saying that she raised over $600,000 from more than 10,000 donations, which made the average contribution about $23. Is $600,000, is that a good number? It doesn't sound like much, but I guess is it a good number at this point in the race?
Well, her team, according to Colleen Marshall at NBC4, is reporting that they beat the previous record for a Democrat, which was former Governor Ted Strickland, who raised $472,000 in 2009. So certainly it's, you know, beating a fundraising record, but Democrats don't really have a front bench or a back bench, and they're not raising money in the way that Republicans are raising money in this state. So, you know, of course you need someone who can raise money to run for office, and she is raising some, but we haven't seen the figures for the Republicans yet. So it kind of remains to be seen in that way. And she's, of course, the likely front runner in the Republican race. And, you know, the candidate who's so far captured the most endorsements is Vivek Ramaswamy. He's, of course, running against Dave Yost, the current attorney general, and Heather Hill of Morgan County. Ramaswamy has a lot of personal wealth, and you've seen that play in two recent races, like now Senator Bernie Moreno's. So it's tough to say, but I mean, she did beat a fundraising record, of course. But, you know, and Democrats need to raise money to win. Any candidate needs to raise money to win, but, you know, you've got Republicans in this race who can fundraise as well.
And Aaron, I know that, you know, the primary for 2026 is a long time away. I'm 13 months-ish or something like that. But do you feel like Amy Acton's running a pretty quiet campaign at this point?
Yeah, I think it'll, I mean, obviously she has name recognition across the state as the former leader of the Department of Health. But I haven't seen a lot of announcements. I mean, we're a long way away from seeing ads and things like that. So it's been pretty quiet so far.
But Ramaswamy, I've seen ads.
Yeah,
already.
I was going to say long ways away normally, but Ramaswamy has certainly been advertising the Trump endorsement since he got it. I've definitely seen those TV hits.
Now, I wanted to pivot for a second to measles. Aaron, the Ohio Department of Health released a statement saying that there were 10 measles cases. That was last week. Now there are 11 measles cases. How concerning are health professionals in the health department here in Ohio taking to deal with this measles outbreak? Because I think it's considered an outbreak once it's more than 3 cases.
Right. And we've seen other outbreaks in the country, mostly in the Southwest U.S. With Arizona and Texas. Department of Health officials are really encouraging everyone to make sure they're vaccinated. I believe all 10 of the cases we've seen so far were people who weren't vaccinated against measles. And it's a 2-dose vaccine. It's 97% effective. So I know that's what people are encouraging. The first case that we saw was a person from Ashtabula County who was in contact with someone who had been outside the country. So that's another factor in how the spread is taking shape so far.
Has anyone else been writing about the measles cases at all?
I went
to a press conference with Department of Health Director Bruce Vanderhoff, and he did just mention, you know, at the same time you see childhood vaccine numbers lagging more and more each year, which he says is concerning because, you know, measles especially is like one of the most contagious diseases. I mean, you can go into a room, according to Vanderhoff, 2 hours after someone who's been infected with measles has been and still pick it up. So, you know, the Department of Health is certainly just encouraging folks to vaccinate their kids, to, you know, look into boosters if a booster is a potential. But
was in that same press conference with Vanderhoff, did he also talk about, did he give any bird flu updates? Do you remember? No.
Okay. It was like 2 weeks ago. So oh, okay. I don't have, that was the last I at least had heard from him. So I don't have great
okay.
info on
yeah.
that.
Yeah, we'll check in on bird flu updates. Okay. There is another story. In 2023, a survey showed that 20% of Ohioans owned some form of cryptocurrency. So one Ohio lawmaker, a Republican representative, spoke about the need to regulate cryptocurrency. So there is a bill that was reintroduced from last session. Sarah, were you covering this cryptocurrency bill?
Yeah, I was.
Okay. So what would this bill do to help provide a regulatory framework for cryptocurrency in Ohio?
Sure. It's some of it's just kind of the basics that you think of when you're adding this new concept to the Ohio Revised Code, because of course the Ohio Constitution and the Ohio Revised Code has language from so long ago, and when these laws were first made, cryptocurrency didn't exist. So some of it is literally just defining cryptocurrency, defining blockchain technology. But it also, you know, the bill bars state and local governments from levying certain taxes or fees or charges that specifically target someone for using a digital currency. So it definitely like embraces cryptocurrency. It doesn't just like define it in state law. It also establishes a state income tax deduction for gains from selling digital assets. And there's another bill that this representative, Steve Demetrio, he's a Republican, introduced that would allow the Ohio treasurer to invest as much as 10% of some state funds from several different sources, including the general fund, in digital assets. So cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. So that bill, HB 18, definitely a harder push, Demetrio says, because it's not just defining cryptocurrency and embracing it if Ohioans want to invest in cryptocurrency. It's taking a step further and investing taxpayer dollars in cryptocurrency.
He also talked about an amendment to address or remove a step for the state retirement systems that they need to go through of where they're investing too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he said that was basically, he told me that that was basically just asking the state retirement systems to look at cryptocurrency and see if it would be wise to invest in it. And he said some of the feedback that he's heard from these pensions is that we're already looking at cryptocurrency, like we don't need a state mandate to like provide you guys. So I think that is the biggest opposition he's gotten from this bill, HB 116. And it sounds like he's either going to completely strip it from the bill or at least pare it way down.
And just for a final story, Aaron, you wrote about a lawsuit that was filed after the after a death at the Franklin County Jail. I'm not sure how to say the name. Is it Jira?
Jira Purdue. Yes. Yeah. This was a tragic case of a woman who died, I think, due to withdrawal symptoms. But she, medical staff had a policy at the Franklin County Jail, not an official policy, of they're supposed to check on an inmate every hour if they are under safety watch, certain conditions. And so they had initialed checks for every hour before they had actually completed the checks. And then when Purdue was discovered unresponsive, tried to shred the log that had these initial checks that they hadn't actually done. And so the jail's own investigation report found that she could have been lying on the floor of her cell unresponsive for hours. We don't know exactly how long. So her mother, Patty Wolf, has filed this lawsuit, not against the Franklin County Jail, but against the medical staff company that they contract with.
Okay, well, we're down to the last minute. What is everyone going to be covering this week? Waiting for the transportation budget to be signed.
Yeah, interested to see if DeWine line item vetoes anything. And then also, of course, looking for the House version of the budget.
Megan?
I'm focused on Senate Bill 1 follow-ups and how people think it's going to impact higher education here in Ohio.
And Aaron, what are you working on this week?
Looking at the House version of the budget and specifically how these private school voucher funding measures up with public school funding.
All right. Well, we will keep on top of it. And I want to say thank you. Thank you to Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Aaron Glenn, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch.
Thank you.
And Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Sarah.
Always good to be here.
This has been All Sides, the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich.